DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty as ever in the worlds of science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, as the number of cases of the new potentially fatal coronavirus increase, the World Health Organization wants countries to review what it calls unusual patterns.
The thing is, the virus is something which causes symptoms that a lot of other viruses cause too. It's unfortunate, but it's difficult to tell often in its early days if this is novel coronavirus.
Also on the programme, meet the people who say Germany's open data portal is more like a closed shop, and find out why there's much more to Tourette's syndrome than just a bunch of curse words. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, the World Health Organization is urging its member states to be aware of the possible spread of a new coronavirus, the virus which can cause severe respiratory illnesses. This came as a fourth person was diagnosed with the potentially fatal virus in Britain, bringing the total number of cases, as we went to air, to 12. This is a new outbreak of an unknown coronavirus, one that seems to have travelled from Saudi Arabia or Pakistan to Europe, and it's one that has been transmitted from person to person. The WHO says countries should continue their surveillance for acute respiratory infections and carefully review any unusual patterns. For more, I spoke to Gregory Hertel of the WHO in Geneva.
Basically, the new cases in the UK have not changed our assessment of the virus in the sense that we still see, we saw before in Saudi Arabia what we believe to be human-to-human transmission. So this appears to be another case of human-to-human transmission in the UK. We also have seen that normally it's pretty close contact, we believe, that causes the ability to transmit. So the virus does not transmit easily between people. And in total, we've only seen 12 cases. So it appears to be a virus which is extremely hard to contract.
Hard to contract, but we are seeing people-to-people or person-to-person transmission, aren't we? But within, one very close situation, a family, for instance.
Yeah, we are seeing very occasional person-to-person transmission when there is close contact.
And what can you tell us about the movement of this coronavirus so far? I mean, we're hearing, of course, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, Pakistan as well has been mentioned, and the UK. Is that an indication of how this might spread, if not contained right now?
Well, of course, this is how, you know, most viruses will spread. Either viruses have to spread via an animal or a human host. And there's movement both of animal populations across large distances, and also, obviously, people do loads of travel internationally. So the virus can spread, and it's not surprising that a virus spreads. I think we have to be aware or conscious of the fact that the virus could well spread. And what we need to do is help public health officials and clinical doctors be as aware as possible of symptoms that might be caused by coronavirus so we can address these quickly.
But what we've been hearing, though, is that this is potentially a new kind of virus that has not been seen before. What should people be looking out for in terms of symptoms?
It is a new virus. It is a virus which can cause severe respiratory distress and obviously also causes fever. So the thing is, the virus is something which causes symptoms that a lot of other viruses cause too. It's unfortunate, but it's difficult to tell often in its early days if this is novel coronavirus. So what would normally happen is that you would test for viruses first, which are much more usual to see, such as flu viruses, for example. And if it doesn't match a flu virus, then you have to think that maybe it's a more unusual virus like this novel coronavirus.
What we've also heard is that it was only by chance, really, that doctors in the UK thought of thinking about this, the possibility that this might be a coronavirus. What can you tell us about that, this element of chance, really, in detecting such a virus?
Well, it depends oftentimes on the, as you say, the awareness and the testing abilities, the ability of doctors, often on an individual basis. It varies from doctor to doctor, as with almost anything else in the world, that you see some people put dots together or think, let's say, outside the box or take all correct decisions. We saw, for example, in SARS, how the path of the outbreak was very different in different cities where an initial case landed, because oftentimes, let's say, a single doctor in a given city took the step of isolating the first SARS patient so that the transmission never got beyond the first patient and was very limited. So again, if you've got a very good clinical doctor who is aware of what's been happening in the world of infectious diseases and of new viruses, this will obviously help in the longer term and in the immediate control of a specific chain of infection.
You mentioned the SARS epidemic of 2003. It's 10 years since then, and people have been talking about SARS in this current case. Is that helpful to be using a term like that at this time, or does it just whip up too much fear?
It's not at all helpful to talk about SARS. And yes, talking about SARS unnecessarily confuses the issue and might cause fear where there is, at this point, absolutely no reason to be talking about anything like SARS.
Gregory Hertel of the World Health Organization in Geneva there. Well, as doctors in Europe grapple with that new coronavirus, scientists in India are claiming to have taken a step closer to a vaccine against the deadly dengue fever. It's being developed at the International Centre for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology in New Delhi, and it's expected to be ready for clinical trials in the next 5 years. Experts believe there's a new carrier about that has caused dengue to spread rapidly recently, forcing thousands to seek hospital care across Asia this year alone. Murali Krishnan reports from New Delhi.
At a local hospital in the Indian capital, Hiralal Pandey, a daily wage labourer, is being treated for dengue. Aside from the muscle aches, pains and a fever he's suffering, Pandey has gone through a phase of blood transfusion to kick up his dipping platelet count because of the crippling fever. I was having high fever and my health was deteriorating, as well as my blood count. I was helpless and brought to the hospital. I hope the doctors help me. I understand this fever is because of mosquitoes. Like Pandey, millions are affected annually with dengue across the globe. In India, over 1 million people are hit annually by the disease, which is considered to be a major factor for mortality among children. There is no licensed vaccine to protect against dengue. Efforts to develop one have been complicated by the fact that there are 4 different strains, all of which circulate in an outbreak zone. But there could be hope, as the International Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology is currently developing a non-infectious dengue vaccine based on the hepatitis B vaccine technology. Professor V.S. Chauhan is the director of the Institute's New Delhi chapter.
We looked at the structure of the virus, and from that structural information, we were able to remove what we call the business end of the virus for immune protection. So we pulled out these small stretches from the outside structure of the virus, as I call business end, and stitched them together. So when we stitched them together and put them in animals to look at immune responses, we are very happy to see that you get good responses to all the 4 viruses and none of them is depressed. You would appreciate that working in animals is one thing and working in humans is totally different.
Vaccine development is a laborious and lengthy process, but speedy development has been a characteristic of the new vaccine industry in India, where both response to a crisis, as in response to Japanese encephalitis and H1N1 flu, with the latter taking just a couple of years to develop, as well as regular development of vaccines, have been speeded up to the extent that a decade or so has been compressed into a few years. The H1N1 flu vaccine, in fact, just took a couple of years to develop. Dr. S. Swaminathan, a key member working on this vaccine, says the clinical trials will be the true test.
Giving protection to all 4 has been a very elusive goal, and it's been going on for about 50, 60 years, I would say. And the challenge is all the more complex because we do not have a good animal model of dengue where you are able to try and assess and predict, the efficacy of a vaccine. So you are essentially kind of working in a blind environment, and an ultimate test for a vaccine is going to be the human. So the clinical trials will be the ones that will tell you if the vaccine is going to work or not.
According to the UN's World Health Organization, between 50 and 100 million dengue infections occur each year in more than 100 countries. After malaria, dengue fever is the second most widespread mosquito-borne disease in the world. Professor Chauhan admits the burden of dengue is enormous, but he remains optimistic.
Making a vaccine against this kind of virus should not be difficult, but it becomes difficult because there are four of them, and all four needs to be addressed. The approach that we've taken, I believe we are only one of the two or the only one who taken this approach. The vaccines are a labor-oriented work because you need to do lots of things in parallel.
The prevalent dengue scenario is so adverse that several big organizations, such as Sanofi Pasteur, Pediatric Dengue Vaccine Initiative, and the Rockefeller Foundation, have come together to find a cure for the disease. Dr. Swaminathan again.
The subunit vaccine that we are trying, we are still in a very preclinical stage. So I would say we are looking at something in about at least 5 years or more before we have a lead candidate that we would progress to clinical trials. We have actually all the four serotypes of dengue viruses circulating in many parts of the world. So it's kind of a global problem, and there are no differences in terms of the disease from one part of the world to the other.
Scientists believe that the estimated total economic burden of dengue on the world is $587 million annually and will only increase. The big question is whether a vaccine will be launched soon enough to stop dengue taking an even bigger toll on life. Murali Krishnan, DW, New Delhi.
And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, always follow us at DW_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Now, the German government has been preparing to launch an open data portal this Tuesday. That's February 19th. The aim is to make various kinds of government data available to the public, seemingly for free. And when the site was announced last year, internet activists and transparency advocates welcomed the government's moves and even took part in workshops and advised the government. But a few weeks before the launch this month, many advocates withdrew their support. Cipona Cimolu has more on what went wrong and what can be expected from the open data portal.
A few months ago, internet activists and transparency advocates in Germany were looking forward to the launch of the official German government's open data platform. They hoped that such a platform would usher in an era of openness and transparency and exploit the internet to maximize the accessibility of government data. Markus Begetal is the founder of Netzpolitik, a blog for freedom and openness on the internet.
There are lots of data sets which are paid by the taxpayers, paid by us, and which are lying in the databases of the government. For example, if you moving into a new city, you want to find a new apartment or house. If you have a data set on the water quality, you can see on a map, if you mix this data set of the water quality with a map, where you should move to.
In Germany, as in many other countries, this information is normally published on the different websites of various authorities. That is, if it's even released on the internet at all. Most of it is only available upon request. This is why activists would like to have a one-stop site where public information can be released in a timely fashion, like it is in the UK and the US, where the governments have open data sites. Christian Heiser from the Open Knowledge Foundation was one of the internet activists who participated in workshops to help the German government with the project. He explains why he and the other activists turned their backs on the government earlier in February.
During the last community workshop, we as representatives of the open data community in Germany realized that the platform is not that what we believe is open government for us.
Heiser was among the 12 internet activists who released a joint statement criticizing the government. In that, he has the support of Markus Begetal, another of the signatories.
We are unhappy that this dialogue failed over the last 2 years, and it looks like they didn't understand anything. There are clear definitions when open data is really open, and other governments, like the British one or the US government, they show us how to use open data in a real open way. But our German government said that they are not willing to use these free principles of open data. They want to sell the data sets.
Unlike the US government's data.gov and the UK's data.gov.uk, Germany's govdata.de won't be free. And for many internet activists, that means that it isn't open. So could Germany's govdata.de be a move in the right direction despite disappointing some activists? Christian Humburg, the head of Transparency International Germany, says that it is.
Of course, anything like this is a step forward. The question is how big this step is. And unfortunately, I think it is a rather very, very small step. First of all, this started under the headline Open Government. And right before the launch, the word open disappeared, which as such is already disappointing. Secondly, we have to remember that we had recently an initiative by the state in Hamburg, in Germany, that has a new transparency law which requires from government to publish data in vast amounts.
Hamburg is in the vanguard here in Germany. While the German federal government's portal will be entirely voluntary and authorities won't be forced to publish information in a manner that is open, accessible, and searchable, the city-state of Hamburg is doing something different.
The developments we see in Hamburg right now is the most interesting development because it is not voluntarily, as I said, but based on the law, and the next 2 years will show how this law will be implemented, which I think is a pretty unique case worldwide of very far-reaching open government and open data requirements for the government.
Most of the open data efforts in the US and the UK are voluntary. Essentially, there are no legal requirements forcing the authorities to release information so that the public can easily access it. But the city of Hamburg's efforts to force the regional government to release information may be linked to the importance of open data for business. Christian Heiser.
At the moment, we are just speaking about transparency and transparency within the democratic process. But I think personally that there is a big opportunity for startups and other businesses in using open data.
In Germany, the cities of Berlin and Munich have launched their open data sites because they recognize the importance of this data for attracting investors. Christian Heiser says that once the push from companies and the private sector increases, the German government may actually have to come up with an open data platform that is actually open.
Chiponda Chimbolu with that report there. And now from open data in Europe to wide open spaces in Africa, where scientists are trying to get a better picture of what's happening to the continent's environment. Climatologists say it's vital to monitor environmental developments to help African nations use their resources in a more sustainable way. But it's a challenge. Weather observation networks in Africa are very limited. And this is where the engineers step in. The Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands and Oregon State University in the US have initiated the so-called Trans-African Hydrometeorological Observatory Project, a big name there. The aim is to design an affordable, dense network of 20,000 weather stations across the African continent. But they want local engineers to be part of the design process too. Laura Pasma reports from Delft in the Netherlands.
Professor Nick van de Giese works at the Faculty of Civil Engineering and Geosciences at the Delft University of Technology. He is one of the initiators of the Trans-African Hydrometeorological Observatory, or TAMO, project, with more than 30 years of experience working in Africa. He explains why the continent needs new weather stations.
The number of measurement stations in Africa are just very, very, very limited. And so if you want to know, for example, the impact of climate change, we don't even know which way the change is going often. We know it for temperature, but especially when it comes to water-related variables like rainfall, we just don't know. We need those data as scientists in order to move further to better understand the African climate and the possibilities that the African continent has in terms of agriculture and other water-related activities.
And to get more data, they need more weather stations. But the weather stations also need to be as cheap as possible. TAMO project aims to install about 20,000 weather stations in different African countries, using locally designed new technology. Van de Giese says they need a lot of rain sensors, like this prototype.
I'm just dropping now with a dripper some water on our rain sensor, which basically measures the sound and then analyzes the sound later on and tells me how big the drops were. And it's a bit of artificial when we run inside, of course, so normally that would be a slightly more natural rainfall sound, more like this. That's what we're doing here. So you hear actually the raw signal from the rain sensor. actually is not much more than a microphone. And so that's really what it is. So it's really a drop that falls on a microphone that produces this typical tick, almost like lying in a tent listening to the rain, or when you're in Africa when the rain is hitting the roof. It's almost the same sound. The only thing we do afterwards is we look exactly at that signal. So we analyze that signal electronically, and then we can say within a few percent how big that drop, one drop, was. And by measuring all these drops, we know exactly how much water there was total, and we also know what the rainfall intensity was.
But this project is bigger than the environment. Van de Giese also wants to change local standards in environmental education by involving African students in a competition to design cost-effective sensors. One such student is 26-year-old Goluaga Olubunmi from Nigeria. He is doing his master's degree in strategic product design at Delft University of Technology. He says he wants to design a device that will mean something for the whole of Africa.
The thing about product design is you find a commonality. It's like there should be a common ground, yeah, for some of the cultures, and that's what you base your design on. You know, you don't base it too much on the differences, and when you think of those type of attributes, then you can resonate it in your products and see the peculiarities to African weather, to African environment, to the climate, and see how you can put that in your design.
Olubunmi has yet to finish his design for the competition. Professor Van de Giese is encouraging participants like Olubunmi to design rain sensors, but he also wants them to investigate dust, smoke and wind. Olubunmi wants to build a rain sensor.
I think that's the primary one, at least the dust, and so it's also important, but maybe the rain is more important because, yeah, what I found out from my little research is that it boils down to everything, because when you know the weather, when you have more statistics about this, it helps the farmers, it helps solve a lot of local issues, and we all know that Africa has a lot of potentials for agriculture, and when agriculture comes, a lot of things follow, so maybe it's good to focus more on that and measuring the rain on getting a lot of data that help the local people in the continent.
Van de Giese hopes to install the 20,000 weather stations at or near schools and to involve the students and teachers there. The plan is also to spread understanding of the project and why it's important for Africa.
And what I've noticed myself with African students, especially when they come into university and stuff like that, they're good with math, but when it comes to practical things like measuring things outside, that's often not as well developed, for the very simple reason they've never had the opportunity to go out and measure things, because the stuff was just not there. There was no thermometer in high school. There was no barometer in high school. So by building a curriculum around measuring the environment and understanding how these measurements relate to what you see at the largest scale around you, also because we have so many stations, what your neighboring stations mean for you and what your measurements mean for your neighboring stations, this connectedness that climate brings with it. We think it would be very interesting to get sort of an environmental curriculum going at high schools that involves more active measurements and more active hands-on experience for students in Africa.
The TAMO project still has a long way to go if it wants to change both the environment and science education. But the deadline for the design competition is just around March 1st. This is Laura Postma for DW in Delft.
Okay, now this is the point in the program when I'd absolutely love to play a clip from the US TV show Curb Your Enthusiasm. You might even know it. It's the one with the French cook in the episode when Larry David and his mates open up a new restaurant. But I can't, because it's full of expletives. And with that, you've probably got an idea. Yes, I'm talking about Tourette's syndrome. But Tourette's is not only about swearing and cursing. People with Tourette's might even display involuntary movements or tics, so they might just interject their otherwise perfectly sensible conversation with random words like biscuit. The condition was first described by a French doctor called Georges Gilles de la Tourette in 1885. But the illness was hardly acknowledged or even researched until the 1990s. There are now a number of drop-in clinics in Germany, so things have changed, especially for Tourette sufferers, of course, who often are in a very bad way. Jesse Wingard has this report by Gudrun Heiser.
I think it ging los mit Augenkniepen. So bis 6, 7, und dann Kopf in den Nacken hauen und...
Hawking, screaming and spitting. They're all part of conversation with Ben Bruns, random and uncontrollable. Sometimes he even jerks a leg forward, involuntarily. But this isn't Ben being weird. They're all tics and typical for Tourette syndrome. Ben can't control his tics or suppress them.
It's like a spring winding itself up. And the more it winds itself up, the more it has to release. It's like a compulsion in my head.
Ben Bruns was diagnosed with Tourette when he was a child. He's just turned 34 and still suffers with tics. They're totally random and can happen any time and anywhere, on a tram or at school, on a casual walk or at the supermarket. People often find it awkward when they're confronted with Tourette sufferers in public. They'd rather not have anything to do with people who shout obscene words. Professor Kirsten Müller-Wahl of the Hanover Medical School says that as a result, Tourette sufferers often also suffer prejudice.
About 20 to 30% of Tourette sufferers have what we call coprolalia, so they have a compulsion to use curse words, but most don't. There's a theory that there's a region in the brain that's central to obscenities, and that this region is not being suppressed enough. But it's just a theory. We don't really know what's happening.
But it is clear that there's a disorder in the brain. In order to make controlled movements, various regions and networks in the brain have to work perfectly together. In Tourette sufferers, these networks tend to be broken and too much of the neurotransmitter dopamine gets released. Professor Jens Kuhn at Cologne's University Clinic describes it as an imbalance. Kuhn treats many Tourette sufferers, including Ben Bruns.
We often treat tics with neuroleptic drugs. They're used to control dopamine release, or rather, they block dopamine receptors.
When adults have severe tics, however, doctors may suggest deep brain stimulation as a treatment. Deep brain stimulation was first developed to treat Parkinson's disease. It helps Parkinson's sufferers to control the shakes, and in Tourette sufferers, it helps with the tics.
The patient has two electrodes implanted in the brain with a relatively small neurosurgical operation, and the implants are attached to an impulse generator, which is like a pacemaker, and that's implanted in the chest.
Ben Bruns received his brain pacemaker in 2006, and at first, everything seemed to be going well.
Things improved by about 60, 70 or 80%. It was great, but then I fell on my head and probes moved. I've had them implanted another 3 times since then. It's okay today. I'm quite happy with a 50% improvement.
Ben prefers to stay at home because he gets stressed when he's with people, and that's when the tics are at their worst.
At school, they used to call me spastic or idiot. And that obviously had an effect on me. They always called me spastic and threatened to beat me up after school.
In 70% of Tourette cases, the symptoms disappear when the sufferer enters adulthood. Ben Bruns still has his tics. He had wanted to train as a retail salesman, but was repeatedly bullied. In March, he wants to try again. He's managed to find an apprenticeship with a company that makes golf clubs, despite his having Tourette syndrome. And this time, he hopes he'll stay.
Jesse Wingard with that report there by Gudrun Heiser. And that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, of course, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfa Karabani. Our studio tech was Ksenia Denchik. Join us next time if you can. Until then, thanks for listening and bye for now.